From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Robbie Feinberg with the news on this day in Maine, Monday, June 17th, 2024.
This Day in Maine is made possible by Now You're Cooking, celebrating 24 years of selling cookware, kitchen tools, gadgets, and fine wine on historic Front Street in downtown Bath, open 7 days a week.
The suspect who was killed following an armed standoff with police in Auburn on Saturday morning had been released from jail just days before over the strong objections of the district attorney's office. But the judge in the case ruled that Leon Hinckley's rights had been violated because the court system had failed to find an attorney to represent him. Ari Snyder reports.
Hinckley was being held without bail at the Androscoggin County Jail for a probation violation stemming from a 2012 conviction for elevated aggravated assault. Hinckley had pleaded guilty to stabbing both his then-girlfriend and a passerby who tried to intervene and was sentenced to 15 years in prison and 4 years of probation. He was released early in 2023. Hinckley was arrested again on May 24th of this year on new charges of domestic violence aggravated assault on another woman. She was granted a protection from abuse order. But the state had not been able to find an attorney to take Hinckley's case. During a bail hearing on June 12th, Judge Sarah Churchill said the state had violated Hinckley's Sixth Amendment rights.
And it was discussed on the record how, you know, the state has had the ability to continue to investigate the case and gather evidence, and Mr. Hinckley, because he doesn't have a lawyer, does not.
Maine's Indigent Legal Defense Services have been in turmoil for years. 2 years ago, the ACLU of Maine filed suit, claiming Maine was violating the Sixth Amendment constitutional rights of low-income and indigent defendants by failing to provide them with attorneys. The problem shows no sign of letting up. In May, the ACLU reported that more than 140 people were in custody without legal representation. Assistant DA Patricia Mader acknowledged Hinckley's need for legal representation, but warned that releasing him could be dangerous, given his history of violence.
The risk of public safety is extreme.
Mader said the court should continue holding Hinckley without bail as it tried to find him an attorney. But Judge Churchill said the situation put the courts in a bind.
I understand the state's concern. It is a balancing analysis for the court to engage in, to try to do something that is in the interests of justice for the system writ large, when it is clear that there has been a significant violation of one of Mr. Hinckley's rights.
Ultimately, Churchill decided to lower Hinckley's bail to $1,500. His conditions of release stipulated he remain under house arrest, except for going to work or medical and legal appointments. Mader requested that Hinckley be subject to electronic monitoring. Judge Churchill agreed, but an electronic monitoring device was not immediately available. Instead, Churchill instructed Hinckley to contact his probation officer within 48 hours of release and inquire about being placed under electronic monitoring. The judge also forbade Hinckley from contacting a woman named Morgan Valaro and from returning to Russell Avenue in Auburn.
And just to be clear, Mr. Hinckley, the no contact with Ms. Valaro is in effect as of right now, just like it was in effect with the prior bail orders even before you leave the jail. Do you understand that?
Yeah, ma'am.
Okay.
But at 1 a.m. on Saturday, according to Auburn's Deputy Chief of Police Tim Kugel, Hinckley returned to Russell Avenue with a gun.
Auburn Communications Center received a 911 call from a female subject living on Russell Ave. She reported that her significant other was in a fight with a male subject trying to break into the residence and that he was armed with a gun.
Police say the woman who made the 911 call escaped through a window and fled down the street. The home and another nearby burned to the ground as police pursued Hinckley, who they say fired on officers. After an hours-long standoff, Maine State Police officers located Hinckley with a firearm on a roof of a house on Russell Avenue. Police say officers shot and killed Hinckley at around 5:30 a.m. Human remains were found in one of the destroyed houses and will be sent to the state medical examiner's office to be identified and to determine a cause of death. A spokesperson for the Maine Department of Safety says the state fire marshal will not be able to determine the cause of the fires, given the extent of the damage. The Maine State Troopers Association and the Maine Fraternal Order of Police issued a statement on Sunday laying blame for the incident on Judge Churchill, based on her decision to allow Hinckley to be released on bail. A spokesperson for the Maine Judicial Branch Monday said in a statement that it is, quote, dangerous and short-sighted to blame the court for the horrific acts. and that the root cause is an insufficient number of attorneys willing to represent the rights of the accused. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Ari Snyder.
An Army Reserve commander on Monday appeared virtually before the special commission investigating the Lewiston shootings and defended how his unit responded to concerns about the deteriorating mental health of the man who carried them out. But some members of the panel expressed frustration that they haven't received more information from the Army. Kevin Miller reports.
Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Vasquez had been testifying for about 2 hours about Robert Card's final months in the Saco-based reserve unit when former U.S. Attorney Paula Silsby asked the big overarching question.
Given the limitations of your authority in these matters, that everything that could have been done by your unit was done with respect to Sergeant Card?
Yes, and some.
As an example, Vasquez pointed to the much-discussed July training mission to New York, when Card falsely accused multiple people of calling him a pedophile, tried to fight a friend, and then locked himself in his room. He said that because so many officers in the 304th Infantry Regiment work in law enforcement, they recognized Card was having a potential mental health breakdown and ordered him to undergo an evaluation at a military hospital.
I don't know a lot of average reserve units that would have handled that better than we did, considering we had the people we had there at the time. A lot of these reserve units are not all police. You could have someone that maybe it's a stay-at-home father, stay-at-home mother. They don't have that type of experience like my guys had.
But when Card was released from a private psychiatric hospital 2 weeks later, his reserve unit leaders were supposed to make sure he was sticking to a mental health treatment plan. They were also supposed to work to ensure that Card, a 20-year reserve veteran described as a highly skilled marksman, would no longer have access to his weapons at home. Neither of those things happened, however. And repeatedly during his testimony on Monday, Vasquez said there was only so much that he, as a reserve commander, can do when his volunteer members return to civilian life.
If they're not compliant with their treatment, I don't have a lot of tools in my toolbox legally to do anything.
Questions have swirled about why more wasn't done to limit his access to guns, especially after a friend and fellow reservist told his unit's leaders that he was concerned Card might commit a mass shooting. In its interim report, the commission strongly criticized a Sagadahoc County sheriff's deputy for not trying harder to find Card and for failing to use Maine's yellow flag law to temporarily seize his guns. But commission members also asked Vasquez whether other reserve officers had downplayed the seriousness of the threat by questioning the reliability of the friend who warned that Card might snap.
I don't know anyone that downplayed the threat that he posed. Anyone who would say that would probably have to say something very similar to the police that went to his house, knocked on his door, didn't get an answer, and left.
Vasquez is one of more than a half dozen reserve members who have testified to the independent commission. Retired Judge Jeffrey Rushlow appeared frustrated at times with the flow of information from the Army, which is conducting its own review.
The investigation is still open, and therefore we've never been provided with documents, interviews of any of the reservists in his unit that I'm aware of. So this has been somewhat of a hindrance to our work, even though the Army was doing its investigation within days of the events.
The commission is expected to produce a final report this summer or fall. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Kevin Miller.
A 12-year-old boy from Portland died on Sunday in the Presumpscot River in Westbrook. The Westbrook Police Department says Roxenbath Rex Rasmea went under the water at around 4 p.m. near the Lincoln Street boat launch. Portland Police and the Maine Warden Service dive teams were deployed to the scene. Officials say rescuers located the boy and pulled him from the river at around 7 p.m. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner is conducting an autopsy to confirm the cause and manner of death. Farmers impacted by contamination from so-called forever chemicals have so far received more than $1 million during the initial rollout of the state's PFAS fund. Nicole Legrisco reports.
State officials say most of the money has gone to farmers who have lost income because their land is contaminated. Three farms so far have applied for state buyouts, and their land is being appraised. The state may decide to buy the contaminated farmland and convert it for some other kind of agricultural purpose, or use the property for research, conservation, or recreation. Three other farms have also expressed interest in a potential buyout. And starting next month, the state will launch a new service through the University of Maine Cooperative Extension to help farmers navigate their options. PFAS fund administrators also say they're working with the Maine CDC to begin blood testing for farmers and members of the public. The $70 million fund will also eventually cover mental health services for farmers and others in the Fairfield area who have been affected by PFAS contamination. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Legrisco.
The federal government has approved Maine's plan for spending more than $270 million in federal funds to expand internet access. Courtney Dozier with the National Telecommunications and Information Administration says the approval will allow Maine to move from planning to action and begin the process for organizations to apply to use the funds.
It means that they can now request access to the more than $271 million that they will need to connect over 42,000 estimated homes and businesses in Maine.
The state expects to open applications this fall. A wood pellet maker in Sanford is facing more than $150,000 in fines after it violated emission standards in its air emissions license from the state. T&D Wood Energy started operating in 2018 and by 2023 had numerous violations related to the height of its plant stack, the operation of its wood dryer, and emissions testing, compliance, and reporting. The company is now entering into a consent agreement with the state to meet its requirements. Company owner Tony Wood.
This consent agreement will let us kind of clear the decks and show that we are operating, you know, within the parameters of our license now, and we have learned a lot in this period of time, and we definitely had some mistakes in the beginning that we didn't know, but we wanted to do right by.
Wood said the pandemic caused delays that led to violations as well. He said they've hired new staff and consultants to ensure compliance. A northeast heat wave will bring temperatures across Maine into the upper 90s for the latter half of the week. Temperatures are expected to spike on Thursday before gradually cooling off on Sunday. John Cannon is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Gray. He says we can expect it to be hot and humid throughout the state, particularly inland.
So if you have a family member or a neighbor who falls into one of these categories, it is essential to check on them when you can and do so even beforehand and make sure they know what the forecast is coming up and ask what their plans are.
Overnight temperatures are expected to be high, which significantly raises the risk of heat stroke and other heat illnesses. So state officials are advising the public to stay out of the sun and stay well hydrated. Meanwhile, the Greater Portland Chamber of Commerce is looking to limit the city's emergency minimum wage ordinance. A referendum passed in 2020 requires a 50% boost in the city's minimum wage for non-remote employees during any state of emergency. But organizers are collecting signatures for a referendum that would restrict the ordinance to only apply during a municipal state of emergency, not a statewide emergency. Chamber CEO Quincy Hensel says the effort originated with local child care providers who had to deal with unexpected expenses this winter when they were forced to boost wages for about a week during a storm that didn't impact the city.
So we do see this posing a real challenge to businesses, and particularly when there's no hazard, there's not an event happening in the city of Portland that would warrant an emergency wage.
Organizers must submit 1,500 signatures by June 20th to get the question on the ballot. And a new electric trash truck, the first of its kind in Maine, is about to hit the streets of Portland. The Super Quiet truck, purchased with mostly grant funding, cost almost $684,000, nearly twice the cost of a diesel model. But the city says it will be cheaper to run because of lower maintenance costs. At an event on Monday, Mayor Mark Dion said having an electric heavy-duty truck marks a huge step towards Portland's goal of switching all its vehicles to electric.
I hope that as a city, this models what other communities in Metro Portland should look at when they're making decisions to purchase new vehicles for their fleet.
A naming contest for the new truck will be open until the end of the month. It will be left up to the public to vote for the winner out of the top five names. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock on Tuesday morning, we'll have a conversation on homesteading here in Maine. I'm Robbie Feinberg. Thanks for listening.